This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Spot after lunch. There's two great big disadvantages of spot after lunch. One, it's that everybody feels a bit, you know, let's say levels sitting down. The other thing is, of course, that you find a lot of things you were going to say were said by people in the morning. So apologies if some of this is repetitive, but I do think some of the things actually bear saying again, perhaps from a slightly different perspective. Just to say a bit about why I'm here, and that's a really good question, because I am not an expert on ETE, so unlike all of you and most of the speakers this morning, ETE is not my area of particular expertise. But I am, as you know, Chief Executive of a Probation Trust, and so my excuse for being here, if you like, is that I've spent all my working life working either directly with offenders in the community, and at one point also in prison, but also working with staff who are working with those offenders. So I think I can say I've got some knowledge about working with offenders, and it's some of that that I wanted to share with you today. Now, some of this you will all know. In fact, you probably know all of it. So, you know, all your grandmas sucking eggs, that's absolutely fine. But again, I think sometimes it's important to remind ourselves about what it is we're actually dealing with. We've heard a lot of technical stuff this morning. We've heard some really good stuff about what different organisations are doing. We've also heard an awful lot about prisons. And one of the things I wanted to say is that the number of offenders that are supervised by the probation service in the community far exceeds the number in prisons. So just hopefully this will come on. That's gone too far, so sorry. So prison population, as of the end of last year, 85,500. It's been hovering around that for quite a long time. The number of offenders supervised by probation trusts, September 2010, which was the last figure I could get, 239,000, of whom 170,000 were in the community, and the others, of course, about to come out. Now, of course, that's not all offenders by any means, because, of course, there's a huge range of offenders that are never seen by probation, and all those people serving under 12-month sentences. Huge issues around those. I'm not going to go anywhere near that today because it's a conference in itself. But just to say that our view, and we might get challenged, but I thought a bit of controversy might keep you awake, is that much resource is going on offender learning and skill development in prisons, and not nearly enough is going on offender learning and skill development in the community. And in fact, community provision is being reduced very considerably. So that's something I want to talk about. You can see the attraction of offender learning in custody because you've got literally a captive audience. So, I mean, that's helpful. So all the problems we have in the community about attrition rates and people dropping out and not turning up and all the rest of it are, you know, minimised in the prison, although I know we've heard this morning about some of the issues that they have with security and so on. But, you know, I think it is a really different approach that you need to make to people in the community. For its start, they've got all sorts of other distractions. I mean, people in prison are usually incredibly bored. You know, prison is a very boring place for most people. I mean, there are excitements in there, but probably not the sort we'd want to promote. But in the community, you know, there's lots of other things to do, isn't there? You know, there's your drugs to go and get, you know, and you've got to sign on for your benefits, and there's your partner driving you up the wall and the kids and all the rest of it. So there's loads of other things to do, which may be far more important at the point we're at than, you know, actually turning up for a class or whatever. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. And the next thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, the scale of the challenge. Now, you know, you all know this, but it's absolutely, when you look at those figures, they are absolutely staggering. If my husband was here, he would say, in 1944, there was an Education Act which introduced compulsory state education for all children up to the age of 15. So that's been going for nearly 70 years. And look at those figures. I mean, these are people who have gone through that system, supposedly, and can't read and write. And these are adults we're talking about, because obviously probation deals with over 18s. So, I mean, I just think it's shameful that's where we are. But that's where we are. So I thought about why. Well, that's why we need to do things with offenders, because the scale of the challenge is so huge. And the other reason is this. I mean, I don't know if you can see this, and it's probably not very clear, but as some of you will know, probation officers do an analysis of offenders called OASIS. So they look at all the problems that offenders have that they think might contribute to their offending. And those are kind of accommodation, ETE, which we're here to talk about, relationships, lifestyle, drugs, alcohol, thinking skills and attitudes. So those are the what they call the domains of OASIS. And every offender gets scaled on this OASIS. And the one I've ringed is the ETE needs. Now, this is a Derbyshire printout, but I don't think it's any different in any other trust in the country. You'll find slight variations. So ETE is a huge need, absolutely no doubt about that. But so is everything else. And that's one of the things I think we need to remember, particularly in the context of a conference like this where we're looking at ETE specifically. That's because offenders, you know, aren't divided up into the ETE bit of me and the drugs bit of me and the alcohol bit of me. They are whole people. And any one of these problems or issues at any given time may actually be the most important thing. So the very first question we need to ask ourselves is, when is it the right time to introduce ETE provision? If somebody has nowhere to live and they're very heavily involved in drugs and they've got problems at home and all the rest of it, is that the right time to start them off on some ETE provision, or do we need to do other things first? So one of the things that probation officers have to do in working with offenders in the community is sequence the interventions that they are going to make with them. Because you can waste, and we talk about resources this morning, you can waste a lot of resources taking somebody to a trough to make them drink at a time when they're not thirsty for that bit. You know, there's other things in their life that is more important. That is not to undermine the importance of ETE, and of course having an employment or having a skill can mitigate a lot of the other problems. So if you're working, you might not get so involved in drugs because you've got other things to occupy your mind and all the rest of it. You might get a decent place to live because you've got a decent income. So, but there is a range of things that offenders need to address. And I think it's very easy, because of the way government is organised, to compartmentalise people into problems that fit with that particular department and not think about the whole. So offenders may face multiple problems, and we talked about when we should provide things. So when and why? The next question is where? And this is a really tricky one. We have for many years in Derbyshire, and I was talking to a colleague from Nottinghamshire as well this morning, provided classes, literacy and numeracy classes, on probation premises. Why do we do that? There's loads of stuff out there. Because offenders will not, in general, walk across the road to the college over the road. College formal systems speak of when I was at school, which I hated, I didn't go because I was bullied or I was excluded for bullying others, or people thought I was smelly or they didn't like me, or I got all behind, so I opted out. So by the time I was 11, I never went anymore anyway, and everybody was very pleased to see me go. So all those formal strategies that are out there, all that formal provision, not for everybody, for many offenders, it just don't work. They won't go there. So we have provided very successfully basic literacy and numeracy classes in our offices. And the beauty is, you go to see your offender manager and, you know, there's a class on, let's go now, and you're in there. And we've had some incredible successes, and I'm sure we're not alone in that. We've had offenders who started at literacy and numeracy level one and have gone on to university. I think that's a huge achievement, absolutely huge. That provision nationally costs very little money. We were talking this morning to the gentleman that was here, a tiny amount of money. It's being withdrawn. So as from July, we won't be able to offer those classes anymore. I think that's a scandal. We need to reinvest in provision on site, because that's the only way we will meet those people's needs. Next question is about how. How do you provide educational and job opportunities to those who find themselves at the bottom of the heap? Because at the moment, as we know, unemployment is rising, and we heard about the problem particularly with young people. It's the same with young adults, probably even worse, because they've even lost out on the youth bit. It's not easy to find employment for offenders when there's a lot of employment about. When there isn't much employment about, and you've got lots of people with lots of good qualifications chasing jobs that are actually below their level of skill, offenders are really going to be at the bottom of the heap. And you're not going to get from employers a very positive reaction to offenders. Why should they employ offenders when there's, you know, 20, 30, 40, 100 other people who are not offenders who can do the job? And why take the chance? So we have got a real problem there. Long, long time ago, when I was a very new, shiny, naive probation officer in another world, the Offenders used to come in and they'd be released from DC or Borstal, Detention Centre or Borstal, as was then, or from prison. And they'd say, I haven't got a job. And I would pick up the phone and I'd phone up the local employer and I'd say, I've got a lad here, he needs a job. Will you help? Will you give him a trial? And they'd say, send him down and we'll have a look at him. And I'd say to the young man sat in front of me, right, you've got a chance here. Don't mess it up, because if you mess it up, the next person who comes along won't get taken on. And that was the way things worked. Now, we've moved aeons away from that. But there is something about a link with employers at some sort of local level that we need to reintroduce, because if you're dealing big scale, big time, you're just not going to get the sort of sympathetic hearing that you need. My next big issue is what? What kind of employment opportunities should we be trying to persuade offenders to look for? And my plea here is for a bit of a reality check. Unrealistic expectations. My other bit of my life, I sit on the parole board. So I sit in oral hearings with offenders, and they sit there and I say, well, what have you done? What are you going to do when you go out if we let you out today? And they said, well, I've done really well because I've spent loads of time in the gym and I've got a gym certificate and I've got this and that. And when I go out, I'm going to be a personal trainer. Now, there are only so many personal trainers the world needs, you know, and it's just not realistic. It's setting people up very literally to fail. And we need to stop doing it, because it's not fair on them. It just isn't. And then, and somebody mentioned it this morning, it's about people's readiness and ability to do a job. It's no good training, I hesitate to say this, it's not very PC, but it's no good training a woman to be a receptionist if, because of her drug abuse, she's got no teeth. Because who is going to want to see somebody sitting on reception who's about 30 years old who hasn't got any teeth? Now, that may seem very cruel, but that is life. And we have to start thinking more realistically, not just about what skills and employability we offer people, but actually about the whole person. How are they going to present when they go for an interview? And we heard this morning some things about teaching people about verbal presentation skills. I think they're really important, because you're not going to get beyond the first point unless you can present yourself in a way that an employer is going to look at and say, well, this looks like a person I would like to see representing my organisation. So that's really the message that I wanted to get across. But the last thing I wanted to say is this, and I've got a little clip, a little interview that I want to play to you in the last couple of minutes. But it's like this. Even if you've got an offender who's got skills, who's got previous experience, who knows his way around the world, he or she will still encounter problems. It is not an easy path. And this is a man who came out of prison. He'd committed committed a sexual offence. I don't know the detail of it, but that was it. And he went for a number of interviews. And this is what he had to say, I hope this is going to work, about the experience of being interviewed. So let's just hope this will work out. So it should hopefully work.
Three interviews now.
Is it going to work?
I've been out of prison just over 4 months. I've applied to many of things in there. I had one which was to do with warehousing. The gentleman in charge was really impressed with me, but unfortunately, once the question of conviction came up, he'd switched off. Which was a bit disheartening. I did try to invent a bit of vigour in selling myself even more, but I was just a bit worried that I would then start looking like I was begging. So it was a fine line. I have got interview skills on both sides, interviewing and interviewing. So it was a case of I just understood that it switched off. It was a really nice job I could have gone for. It was all within my remit of restrictions, so I would have been really suited there. But unfortunately, it was the director himself that interviewed me, but he just obviously didn't want to tell that risk. I then went for one at the train station as a cleaner of the actual station itself. It was really nice to know that the actual person interviewing me had said he got his own background. He'd only asked me if I'd got a criminal conviction, which I said yes. And he said that he didn't want to know anything about it. He just really wanted to know what my experience was. I was within a whisker of getting the job. Just unfortunately, someone had a bit more experience in that actual line to actually do that job. But again, that would have got me back on my feet. But it was good because he was, again, impressed with my maestry, and he was also wanting me to be kept on file. So there was still a chance, you never know. And then my third one was the Sainsbury's, which again went really, really well. Remploy went out and stuck the neck out to actually organise for me to actually be given the opportunity of the four-week trial. It was just unfortunate of what did happen. And mystery phone call, which messed up my chances. But my head's not down. It's for me, it's just a learning curve, and it's just a case of just not look backwards. I've got to look forwards.
So, I don't know if you heard the Sainsbury's thing. It wasn't very clear. He got a temporary job at Sainsbury's. They were about to take him on permanently, and an anonymous phone call came in, and then they finished him. And I think it's not so much, it's as much what he says, but the tone of his voice. I'm remaining optimistic. There might be a chance here, but you can hear an underlying sort of growing recognition that this is going to be really tough. And that's the way I'm afraid it's going to be. So, sort of conclusions, really. Offenders face multiple problems, both in seeking to improve their skills and if they have got skills in getting employment, and we all know that. We know also that one of the key drivers to reducing reoffending is work. So there's a dilemma for us. Many offenders have skills, but they face prejudice from employers. And in this competitive market, well, who can blame the employers, really? For most of the other people we see, we need to provide the basic education that has eluded them. And we need to find a way of doing that that is favourable to them, that they can access and they feel comfortable with. Otherwise, we won't get off square one. We need to persuade employers to look past criminal convictions for those who have got the skills and qualifications that they can use. You know, somebody's been punished for their offence within the requirements of the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act. There actually is no reason why those people can't have work. We need to provide tailored, accessible, non-threatening ETE provision for those who lack educational qualifications. And we need to ensure that we don't raise unrealistic expectations of what a qualification might lead to, particularly in the current economic climate. Nick talked this morning, of those that were here, about the whole prison and the whole prisoner. In terms of the community, I think we should talk about the whole offender, so all their needs, and actually the responsibility of the whole of society to rehabilitate people. So a mixed message for after lunch, but hopefully food for thought. Thank you.